You're listening to the Product Podcast from Product School, featuring the best product leaders from Silicon Valley and beyond. If you're an aspiring product manager looking for your first PM role, or an experienced PM looking to level up your skills and advance your career, visit productschool.com to learn about our certifications and how we'll get you there. In this episode, we're live with a panel delving into the journey into the tech industry, exploring the diverse roles of PMs and sharing invaluable real-world experiences. Join our experts as they uncover the secrets to successful transitions, building a robust professional community, and acquiring the skills that distinguish you in the ever-evolving tech landscape.
Hey, everyone. This is Carlos. I'm the CEO at Product School. Today, I'm here with Mercy Grace, CEO at Novi, who just launched her company a week ago. So congrats and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Carlos.
Mercy, we need to start from the top. Tell us a little bit more about the baby.
Yeah, so I'm very excited about Panobi. It is a product that we built for product managers and marketers to execute well on everything that they do every day, but maintain an eye line towards strategy and learn how to communicate that strategy while still executing really well on the details.
Growth, magic word, probably too used by so many teams. So I'm curious to learn from your own experience. How do you define growth in technology companies?
Yeah, growth in tech companies is really kind of the number one goal and the whole point of capitalism, the whole point of venture backing. And I think it's really best, most broadly, designed that way with the mind that it's something that the whole company does together. And then you often have one team at that company that's really tasked with executing well on that, being the tip of the spear, but it should be an entire company effort. And the most successful growth teams are ones that have executive buy-in and are able to pull in resources from other teams to execute.
And so I want to break that down with you because I see in your professional experience, you've been a product manager, you've worked also on growth teams, you've been an investor and now CEO. So starting from the beginning, a bit more about when you actually learned that growth is actually the key for tech companies.
Yeah, so my first job in tech was actually as the founder of a venture-backed company. So right away, I totally jumped into the deep end and I raised a Series Seed and then a Series A for this very weird game called the Passively Multiplayer Online Game. And it was a little browser extension. And so understanding kind of from the get-go and really learning, and I was, 22, 23, understanding, talking to VCs, having a board and serving on the board myself was really my first total immersion in the fact that growth is really how companies live or die.
And then I saw that you work as a product manager at a company that is very dear to my heart called Couchsurfing.
Yeah.
For people who are not familiar with that startup, and then what growth meant there?
Yeah, so Couchsurfing was really this global community, I think still exists largely in that same forum today, that had been a nonprofit that was literally coded by hundreds of people all over the world. And then actually a huge driver of our growth was every summer, people in the US and South America would fly over to Europe and Southeast Asia, and people from those countries would fly over to, North America, Central America, and South America in kind of this great, global summer exchange. And rooting the sort of heartbeat of each of those cities were these weekly parties. And it was a totally grassroots, community-driven effort. And what was funny is that the Airbnb founders saw that kind of product market fit. And I remember seeing their, I think it was their YC demo day pitch, they referenced Couchsurfing's product market fit as being sort of like the basis to make them think that there was something there. And I thought it was so funny because it really shows how, the culture and the mindset of the founders is fundamental into how something grows and whether it grows, to venture expectations. So the founders of Airbnb, their origin story, and I don't know if this is literally true, but what they say is that I think, some huge conference was in town. And so they were renting out an air mattress, an airbed in their apartment and, breakfast, I think cereal, to people who, to friends and friends of friends who wanted to stay. And so it's like there's the kind of people who are commercially minded enough that they would charge their friend to stay on an airbed in their living room. And then there's the couch surfing founders, you know, who didn't monetize for a very long time and were building this, you know, massive community, but that definitely reached its sort of peak much, much before the Airbnb folks who continue to like go on and really become this, you know, iconic public company. And they were folks who would never dream of charging someone to stay, you know, on an airbed.
It's really fascinating, but it's true that a lot of these companies, they always had some sort of growth, and some of those channels that they used at the beginning saturated one way or the other, and they had to find another growth channel. But it seems like there always has to be something relatively new for the company, depending on the stage they are, to continue that evolution. Curious to know if there's any specific framework or how you think about this type of growth for the different stages of a company.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first kind of growth that you need to get a hold of is understanding, you know, how many people have the problem or the opportunity that we're going to be, you know, turning into a business, or seeing if there's a business there. And then will people outside of your network use it? And then, you know, past that, can you explore different channels and actually, you know, drive adoption? And that tends to be the sort of like pre-seed and seed stage if you're talking about a venture-backed company. By the time you're raising a Series A, you should have product market fit that you can demonstrate kind of based on your business type and the, you know, type of investors that you'd be getting funds from, that you could like prove it with data. But then what you're discovering in that next tranche of growth is, okay, now that we have product market fit, what does go-to-market look like? And how can we build a model for that go-to-market, fund it with the Series E funds to understand, ideally, you know, by the time you go to raise your Series B, I can put a dollar in the top of this machine and I can get $1.30 out, because then you're a fundable Series B company, at which point you say, okay, now we're raising Series B funds to go and do that. And then apart from that, often it's, you know, these very interesting tranches of either getting new customers, so opening up the aperture. For Figma, you know, another iconic company, there's the sort of design user. And then, you know, they recently released the developer tool, and they're charging for that in a way that they hadn't been before. And they also went multi-product with releasing FigJam. So companies like Stripe have grown by increasing their products. And then Slack and Figma both grew by opening the aperture and having, you know, more and more functions in. And for Slack, it was adding in enterprises and building a bunch of products for them.
Yeah, but let's talk about that, because you also became the head of growth at Slack.
Yeah.
So first of all, how was that growth team was created? Why wasn't that part of marketing or product or any other function?
Yeah. So at Slack, it was part of the product function. And that was really because, man, you can do growth many ways. And I think it's like, if your CEO is more of a product person, it'll probably end up in product. If they're more of a marketer, it will probably end up in marketing. There honestly isn't a right or wrong answer here. This will probably sound familiar to the folks that are listening right now, as, you know, PMs. You know, you can feel like you're crushing it at your job and, you know, this certain company, and then get rejected when you apply for roles at other companies or not do as well in another company. It's because product is this weird function that we sort of like fit to match what already exists in a company, the personalities of the founders and the business model. Growth teams are exactly the same. So when I joined Slack, they had, you know, incredible product market fit. People were coming, they were staying, they were inviting people. And then at the same time, on my first day of work there, I asked, hey, what does the conversion funnel look like? I'd love to get some base rates before I go redesign onboarding, which had been sort of my project going in. And they were like, the what? So they didn't have a, you know, front-end instrumentation. I'm like, all right, well, cool. That's my job. I'm a, you know, a startup PM in my heart of hearts. And so I just got Mixpanel off the shelf, had an engineer, you know, put it in, then like, boom, we have our first funnel, and I'm doing user research with Google Ventures and running a design sprint, and we were off to the races from there. But yeah, everyone starts somewhere.
So in Slack's case, it seems like, I mean, so another iconic brand started with tremendous love by the user, and those users inviting other users, and by the next time you know, a decision maker is to get that product because there are way too many people who are already getting value from the free product.
Yeah.
Right. But then obviously you mentioned you have to orchestrate that to do it at scale and reach other companies and more functions within the company. So yeah. What would be some of those different stages that you experienced as a head of growth?
Yeah. So the first thing that we were just very focused on was really making onboarding very good. And our hypothesis there is that, okay, if we increase what we were calling the rate of activation, which will be probably a familiar term to the audience, is it that, you know, we're just, the first question is sort of like, hey, are these cohorts, these early cohorts, are they doing well because they already have high intent and they already have an idea of how to use Slack? And so that will peter out at some point, or as the top of funnel grows for a product like Slack, and you get past the early adopters, and then you get to people who in user research studies, it turns out like don't know what a URL is. If you say a link, they might understand, but it's like these are people who use tech every day, and they might not understand sort of like the ins and outs of these like early tech companies. But is it so? Can you take those people and translate their maybe not even very strong interest or knowledge into retained usage? And so understanding your customer is this constantly evolving process. And I think much in the same way that we have now seen some companies, as the macroeconomic environment has gotten more difficult and raising money is a lot harder, that companies have kind of lost their product market fit. And that's not something that we've seen a lot of in the last 10 years. And I think we'll see like more of that certainly we are right now and probably for the next 12 to 18 months.
And I think the word growth has been so used that it, in many cases, lost a little bit of that fundamental meaning. Some people have used that word to talk about user growth. Some people might have used that to talk about retention growth or revenue growth. So what I'm hearing from you is that there are specific parts of that funnel that require growth. This is not just about putting people on top for the sake of it at any cost.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also, yeah, constantly maintaining an eye to, are you building a model where you understand, where you're getting people from, how much it costs to acquire those folks, the effort that it takes either in the product or also with your sales, human touch team. And then are you able to convert those people into retained revenue dollars? And I think that's a lot of the, like, I saw a lot of that at Slack and, led the product-led growth part of it, but then having the incredible opportunity to join Lightspeed Venture Partners and be an active investor there and be a board member really helped draw all of this into incredible focus for me. And I felt like I got to, get my MBA by working at a venture fund, which was really,
That's a very interesting move, right? We're founder, PM, head of growth, then VC. So why did you choose to become an investor?
Almost no one gets to be a VC. There are very few number of, these really top tier firms, like Lightspeed, like Index, Andreessen, Benchmark, Sequoia, that have these great reputations and the willingness and ability to sort of like bring in new talent to, take over in years and years. And after I left Slack as the head of growth, I started getting inbound interest from venture firms in joining as a partner. And, I'd raised venture early in my career. I knew that at some point I was probably going to start another company. But when a door like this like opens, go through it. very few chances like this exist. Jump in. Like, absolutely.
Actually, love that there are more VC firms actually bringing operators as investors. They have real understanding on how to grow products. But I'm curious to know, why do you think that now investors are not just hiring professional finance people to become an investor, but also startup founders, PMs, and growth leaders?
Yeah, it's very competitive to get into great deals, especially early on, because really like the combination of two things, the price at which you were able to buy stock in a company and the level of ownership that you have in that company, that's really all that matters in venture. And so if you are hiring, you know, partners out of early people at like Stripe and Square and Slack and, you know, Instagram, then you're hiring the peers and former colleagues of people who will probably go on and start sort of that next generation of companies. So I think just straight up access to that network is a huge reason that people do it. And then, you know, second to winning the right to invest in a company, the other thing that really matters is just like being able to pick the right companies to invest in. And operators have spent entire careers using software, choosing it, buying it with their teams. And so especially for B2B companies, people who have that really like deep expertise of what it's like to be at those companies will see things for the value that they bring to the end user in a way that if you have been, you know, a financier for your whole career, you may not have that sort of innate understanding.
So when you were working as an investor and seeing all of these different companies apply growth, what would you say are those key indicators that would tell you that a specific company has a sustainable approach to growth that is going to continue over time versus a leaky bucket that eventually is going to be outpriced by some of the paid acquisition channels or competition?
Yeah, it really shows up in your retention data. So in consumer and in enterprise, but especially in consumer, you know, where the noise at the top can be so incredible and you can get, you know, tens of thousands and then, you know, hundreds of thousands of people joining an app in very short periods of time, you want to look at their, you know, lifetime retention. And if there's even a small number of people who just always retain, that's the foundation that you can build a business on, even if it's really early and you're going to be slowly driving up that number. So it's not 10%, you know, it's 20%. And you're just, you know, really making, you know, a lot more money from doing that. That's huge. And that's kind of, I think, that's the foundation for any kind of growth. And then the other thing that I look at is whether companies are measuring their growth in a way that makes sense. I think so much has been out there, you know, thanks to programs like yours and like Reforge. And there's so much great content on the internet now about which metrics to measure, like Lenny's newsletter is a great source of that as well. And so more and more, I think founders are looking at the right metrics and also have the right benchmarks in mind for what good looks like for their own companies.
Yeah, there's definitely more education and awareness on both ends for the investors as well as for the operators in terms of what good growth means. I think I remember back in the day, a lot of founders would just use investors' money to grow certain metrics such as new emails who sign up.
Yeah.
But the retention wasn't there. And now there's a common understanding of the growth being not just a funnel, but a flywheel. And how retention is actually the engine for growth. And then staying there, how you can continue extending the lifetime value of a user or upselling that user or leveraging that user to bring net new users. It's an entire science around growth that I think ultimately benefits all the players in the ecosystem.
Yeah, and I love that about working in technology is that, you know, everyone who works in tech, I feel like, is a lifelong learner. That's part of why tech is so fun because, you know, there's always something new to learn. You know, it's crypto, it's AI, it's fun. And so the fact that you like have to continue and like bob and weave and find these new channels for growth and new frameworks, and then you want to go share that with other people, mostly because it has been so joyful for you to learn in the first place.
Yeah, and I remember when some of these started being shared, it got bad press. Like people would call this growth hacking, as if they were doing some sort of black magic to grow something that shouldn't grow. And now it's becoming more of a science where it's real growth that is connected to the product that you are building, that is connected to the financial of your companies. And sure, there's some specific steps that anyone can take, but there's also a part of an art that requires try and error. And I think that is a beautiful part of it, which is there is no one single playbook. The playbook says you also have to experiment. And if you don't experiment, you're probably not going to get it right every time.
Yeah, exactly.
So now going back to building, you saw this movie in different places as a founder, PM, VC, head of growth. And now, again, company from, yeah. from zero. In this case, you're actually building a growth tool, right?
Yeah. It's a tool for product managers and marketers, my people.
So, let's talk about it. It's your people, right? And I've seen a lot of founders who first build for themselves. And I think that's a good way to start because you can't just fake that passion. You've probably felt that pain using different tools here and there. And just curious to know, what is it that you were actually missing that you couldn't get from, you know, other things, even if they weren't fully optimized for growth people?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing that you miss out are lost opportunities and lost time. So I would spend, and people on my team would spend a full day a week, every other week, because that's when we reported our growth numbers. And that growth report is something we now write for teams automatically using AI in Panopi. And it would just be pretty simple. Here's what we shipped before. Here are things that are coming up. Any other insights from that? And then here are the week over week changes to these core metrics that we care about. It shouldn't take a data scientist and a PM a full day at work to bring that together. It should be instant, but it's not because all of this data is siloed across all of these different functions because it's, you know, all of these sort of like deep expertise live in whatever their version of a BI tool is or something similar. So I think first and foremost, it's that it is so hard to communicate strategy and manage up. I mean, that's something that you're constantly learning in your career, but that is pretty acute, especially in your like sort of early and mid career. You're trying to make that jump from a senior PM to a director level PM. You're trying to finally get that head of growth title. You know, you want to be a VP product one day. The gap between where you are right now, executing really well every day, winning for the company, you know, making friends with your engineers, making more money, finding new customers. If you can't translate that into the win for the company and how it's positively impacting your strategy, that's the gap between, you know, even a senior PM and a director level person, and certainly between director and VP, is being able to connect everything that you're doing back to one of those P0 goals for your company. And so we are an all-in-one tool to make that much easier for you.
You know, this all-in-one concept, it's interesting because I've seen a lot of SaaS companies that try to be the all-in-one and at the same time they integrate with other players. So what is your take on being that all-in-one platform for growth teams while also allowing information or data to flow from your product to others and from others to your product?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're taking a very integration-first approach, an integration forward approach. I think one of the things that's not sort of well known about Slack early on is that we built the first 70 integrations internally at Slack before we had an open API and we had developers on our platform. And so we went for it, you know, basically tons of engineering integrations and product management integrations, because they're sort of the core adopters of Slack, those startups. And so we're doing something similar at Panopi. You can come in and from nothing, you can upload a CSV and get your metrics in or connect Google Sheets. Next week, it'll be Google Analytics. And you can come, you know, put together your project board on there too, showing the experiments that you're working on, things that people are already doing in LaunchDarkly, in Google Sheets or Notion, but then we connect directly to your code base. So we connect to your future Slack provider, so that your projects are actually up to date. And we pull in the data every day to save you a bunch of time there as well. So we are making sure that we're just like covering our bases and providing that day zero value to people before they've integrated data sources, but that the more data sources you integrate, the smarter and faster and better you become.
And Mercy, how are you thinking about AI as an acceleration force for your product?
Yeah, you know, AI and specifically, you know, these LLMs that you can train and that can do a pretty good job of writing content are great, but they're, you know, another enabling technology in the same way that anything, you know, Flash was at first and then HTML5 and in games. You still have to have the right data set and also kind of the problem that people need solved.
Because I remember vividly the situations in a conference room or virtual room where people are trying to figure out what's going on with something on the website, on the funnel, on the report. And someone would say, well, we need to A-B test this, or we need to run an experiment. But sometimes those experiments can be biased, or they are not the right experiment. So I think that even before an experiment is run, I'm always very interested in knowing how do we go about picking the right experiments and then truly giving them the time to decide if that experiment is working or not. So I guess AI can also play a key role in helping identify different combinations of experiments and even launch some of them to move to get us to the truth faster.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what AI can do is a little bit, you know, like the self-driving cars. I don't know if you've been in a Waymo, for instance, but it's incredible. It's basically the experience of driving with the best driver that you ever had. And they really outperform Tesla in this regard. But so you're in this car that has, you know, I think it's cameras like, you know, all around it. So it is getting all of the data and not just what you're looking at. And I think that the same will be true for applications for AI and growth. So here we are, you know, as product managers and engineers, the tools that we have access to are like our brains and our hands. So we look at data and we're like, let's run an experiment, see if we can modify, you know, the story that this data is telling us. When in actuality, like, you may not have run through the entire list of things that could be the reason why you're seeing this data. So you had a feature launch from another team that you're not accounting for. There was a big sales event that you didn't know about. There was press that you also didn't know about. It's a holiday in Southeast Asia and you had no idea. And these are all factors that often do end up being the reason for big spikes or drops in data. And it is very time consuming and laborious to sort of go try to find all of those, as opposed to a product like Panobi serving you, hey, here are likely things that it could be, because it might not actually be. You know, I think being totally focused on experimentation is like also not where we are. We're not a feature flagging tool because it's not always the answer. Sometimes the answer is you need to run a usability study. And sometimes the answer is, hey, this thing was from this PR spike or from Golden Week in Japan, and it'll simmer down.
Exactly. I find that there's a lot of opportunity kind of in the pre-experiment phase, because not everything has to be an experiment. And if you can get to the answer even before, that's great. I also see opportunity on the post-experiment phase. A lot of companies are good at pushing data out. But then it's expected for the human to make sense of that data and bring the insight. So I hope that AI can also do some of that heavy lifting and identify exactly why something happened and even what to do next.
Yeah. Yeah, though I don't know if like how many of these like products you've been using really sort of like putting through the ringer yourself. I mean, they're incredible, but there, you know, we want a firm answer, but I'm afraid like there are very few totally certain answers in life. And certainly, you know, any large language model is only going to give you something that it's like, hey, this is probably true, but it may have hallucinated something as well. And human judgment and the context that human beings have is incredible. We are, you know, thinking, we're cognition machines that have evolved for hundreds of millions of years in order to do things like understand the emotional state of the person who's sitting across from us. You're not going to necessarily computer your way out of things that human beings are uniquely good at, but we can use them, for instance, to, you know, read through hundreds of thousands of pages of, you know, user research interviews and pull back insights for you, things like that. But the application of these tools, like at the, like, go do this thing that's repetitious, though take me a long time to do, is really perfect. And then we'll see. I mean, they get better every day, so don't bomb me, my AI overlords.
And Mercy, I hear you talk about how important it is for professionals to share, communicate effectively the wins or what's the value of their work. In your particular case with Panobi, what would be some examples for a PM or a marketer who is running experiments to highlight those learnings to an executive who is not in the day-to-day using that tool?
Yeah. So you've probably spent, you know, all of your time making sure that you were running the right experiment and getting all of those details right. And it's really hard to do this. And this is sort of the P0 thing about managing up. And what Vobi can help you do specifically is you can get your experiment results and your top line business metrics into the tool. And then you can have open, here's the details of this experiment, but it helps you zoom out to see, here are also things that ran during that time. You know, here are other factors that could be at play, because that executive, you know, it often feels like they're coming in and you're saying, hey, here's the story. It went from like A to B, but you're just telling them facts. You're not imparting knowledge. And so the more that you can focus on, okay, like what did we learn from this? Not just what was the focus of this experiment, and then go to them really not for approval or accolades, but to say, hey, you know, you run marketing or you run product or you're the CEO. What context do you have that I don't have? You know, what are other things that could be impacting this? Are we focused against the right, you know, top line metric? Is there anything that we should change? I think, you know, the most successful people at companies learn early on that that management is really a two-way street. There's the person who is, you know, responsible for you as a member of their team, but it's your responsibility to get great feedback from them and to learn and adapt to what the company needs from you.
In terms of making growth a company-wide initiative, so it doesn't fall on the product team shoulder or the marketing team shoulder.
Yeah.
What are some ways you've seen that other people can embrace these?
Yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, should be experimenting and should be approaching their work thinking about, you know, what is the impact to the company? If I reduce lag, that does end up being dollars of revenue. Understand what that is. And actually, you know, for the sake of your own career, try to come up with a number that reflects that. And so always pull data into those decisions. And then I think the thing that I often like react against is early on running the growth team at Slack, I had a phone call with a guy who's an incredible growth thinker, and he'd run, you know, really important growth teams and was also an investor. And he told me that growth teams should, you know, be the kind of like hacker type mentality, and that if you weren't making enemies, you weren't doing a good job at growth. And I'm like, okay, it doesn't need to be like that. And that was not Slack's culture at all. You know, I would not have been there for very long if I were an enemy-making type person. And I think the main thing that all these other functions that a company can do is share data with a growth team and, you know, be open and helpful. It can be a little bit of a competitive thing with the sales team, who, you know, in terms of deal attribution, and sometimes with design and product, because they're like, hey, we spent forever, you know, designing this sidebar, and now you just want to put a big invite button on there. But I think the thing that especially leadership can do, and that, you know, every line level PM should have this mentality as well, is we're on the same team. It's the outside that's full of baddies. Like inside, it's just us. I want this company to be successful, and so do you. Let's help each other get there. And the more that executives model that for their teams, the more successful everyone will be in growing the eventual outcome of that company.
I love that. And I'm trying to picture who are the executives that would be more risk averse to this, right? I can imagine functions like maybe finance or operations, where they still want to have their checklist. And then you have the marketers and the designers and the product people trying to experiment with new things. So at the end of the day, like the head of growth role, it's not always represented at the top, right? I haven't seen a chief growth officer. So I'm curious to know, how do you see the future of this function evolve? Do you see it still as part of a product or marketing team, or do you eventually see that there will be dedicated growth functions?
Yeah, I think that the most successful teams, because it is such a cross-functional effort, especially at these enterprise companies that also have what is frankly a consumer model, going and acquiring, you know, devs or acquiring people through a PLG motion, having a chief growth officer or a VP of growth that then manages, you know, engineering, design, data, product, and marketing, it just gives them the right kind of honeycomb shape that they can then you know, do something very productive with, but they need that right structure in order to say, hey, if we do need to push back on marketing, we have actual ownership there. If we do need to push back on Eng or on sales or customer success, we have like buy-in and ownership and authority at that same level.
That's a good point, because I think sometimes companies would think, well, we need growth, so we're going to hire this growth person. But growth needs to be set up for success. And you are going to need eventually engineering, marketing, design, or other types of resources to successfully run experiments at scale and not just A/B test a button here and there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Growth can get rat-holed into, oh, you're the folks who just like own the onboarding funnel, and then it becomes, then these are our customers. And it's like, these are our customers. If people take one thing from this, it's that, man, if you are not on the same team with everyone at your company, get on that team or get out of that company.
That's a great way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for your time, Mercy. It's been a pleasure to learn from you.
Likewise. Thank you, Carlos.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the world to us if you would rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Taking the time to write just a few sentences about what you love most about the show will help us improve it and reach even more product people around the world. And when you're done, why not reward yourself with some free product management content and resources over at productschool.com? Until next time, stay product-led.